debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. A lot coming up in today's program. We're doing a Conversations with Great Minds with Mary Trump on her new book, The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. But today is day 16 of the hunger strike of my colleague on SiriusXM Radio, Joe Madison. And, you know, will he survive? We're all very concerned about this and about voting rights, which is what he is hunger striking for. On the line with us, the Black Eagle, Joe Madison. Joe, welcome back to the program. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing fine. You know, I will respond to the one thing, will I survive? The question really should be, will our democracy survive if we don't get one of these two bills passed, the Freedom to Vote Act or the John Lewis Voter Advancement Act? That's really the concern. And I don't know if any of us, quite honestly, want to survive if democracy is destroyed or defeated by, you know, 50 senators that don't seem to have the courage to do what their predecessors did, what, in 2006, when 98 members of the Senate voted to, by the way, extend the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So that's what I'm motivated to do, what I'm doing. And quite honestly, Tom, the response has been overwhelming because everybody seems to be consolidating their efforts to convince the Senate to do the right thing.
Yeah. Joe, by the way, can be heard every morning, weekdays, 6 to 10 a.m. on SiriusXM channel 126. And you can find all the information about him at joemadison.com. You can tweet him at MadisonSiriusXM. What kind of reception are you getting from elected officials? What sort of feedback have you got?
Well, the biggest feedback has come from people like Senator Jeff Merkley, who, you know, is like, keep doing what you're doing. I've heard from former Attorney General Eric Holder, who is in conversation with Senate Majority Leader Schumer. He said, I mean, he's pushing Schumer. I heard from Congressman Clyburn, who said that they think they'll be able to get the John Lewis bill through. And then I'm hearing from state legislators, and these are basically Democrats, as you can imagine, who are saying, you know, we're going to do what we can. I mean, that's what's kind of keeping my spirits up, especially talking to people who seem to be having some back channel discussions.
The Senate is out this whole week. Are they coming back next week? Is that when you're hoping that they will punch a hole in the filibuster and allow for a vote on voting rights legislation?
Look, that my hope is while they're out, your audience, my audience, and anybody else's audience, look, no one person can do this alone. This isn't about me. This is about everybody. You know, the senators at home, they're at home like you are and everybody else enjoying their Thanksgiving dinner, and they should reflect on what their obligation is so that when they come back, and yes, I know that the Build Better Back a bill has got to be priority. But, you know, I said it the other, I had a political science professor from Howard University said the Democrats have got to learn how to pat their head and rub their stomach at the same time.
Yeah.
and you know, like we used to do when we were kids.
Right.
So they can't waste time coming back, and then because the calendar is our enemy at this point in time, and so if they can, as you call it, nuke the filibuster, then that is a major step. Or, quite honestly, as Senator Kaine told me from Virginia, the Freedom to Vote Act could encompass also the John Lewis voter. A bill. So they've got three bites at the apple. Just take one. And I know people are very pessimistic that they're not going to find 10 Republicans who are honest enough to know that they should be voting for this. But, you know, I guess miracles do happen. It'll probably take a miracle. But, you know, the point is, this is the time while everyone is at home to put the pressure on and hold their feet to the fire. And I'll say this without fear of contradiction. You know, damn it, Joe Biden wouldn't have been able to sign that landmark bill with the infrastructure. We put that pen in his hand. And so he owes us. And then I told you I had, was it Attorney General Clapper on my show? And he said one of the things people should understand is that Putin and the Chinese are loving this, and they're hoping that these bills don't pass. And so, I'm just simply saying this is not just about the black vote, although I think we were targeted because of it, but it's all our allies and our friends. It's the elderly, like up in Wisconsin. That situation is crazy with the nursing home situation where they want to put voter registration workers in jail, as right. proposed by Senator Johnson. You know, this is the time to really push. And so I'm working with you and any organization out there, and people are really responding.
That's great. I mean, you're so right, Joe. And what's astonishing to me, and I'd love to get your take on how America has changed, is that, you know, the Voting Rights Act had to be renewed, as I recall, every 10 years. And here it is, you know, the last time it was renewed, all the Republicans voted for it. Then the Supreme Court gutted it. And now none of the Republicans have an interest in this. What, in your opinion, caused such a change in the GOP?
Donald Trump.
Yeah. Yeah.
Donald Trump. I mean, that's exactly what has caused this change. I mean, you know, this is it. And the fact that he got defeated. Look, if he had not gotten defeated, there wouldn't be these voter suppression laws that you talk about and I talk about on our show, Tom, and this is history repeating itself from 1877, as you've talked about the end of the first Reconstruction. Tom, gee, what did they go after? The first thing that these white Southerners when they saw their world turned upside down, where newly freed slaves ended up holding office, being elected to the Senate, being elected to Congress, being elected to state legislatures. They then cut that deal with Rutherford B. Hayes, and the first thing they went after was the vote. And what happened? They started assassinating people, lynching people. So here's we are now, you know, two, three, four generations later, and it's like, what's the first thing they want to go after? The vote. And so we have an obligation to protect democracy. So I decided I've got to do something personally. I'm not going to sit back and have my children 10, 20, 30 years from now saying that their father let this happen.
Yeah.
And that's the attitude. So it's, you know, some people can do a hunger strike. Some people are doing petitions. Some folks are wearing the senators' lines and they're faxing and texting but everybody can do something. And so I hope when they return from their Thanksgiving, while they're on their Thanksgiving recess, Tom, that they will focus on this situation and do the right thing and put this on the front burner.
Yeah,
it's, and get this done.
It is critical stuff. Joe Madison on day 16 of his hunger strike. JoeMadison.com. You can hear him on Sirius XM every weekday, 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern time on Sirius Channel 126. Madison Sirius XM on Twitter. Joe, thanks so much for dropping by, and good luck. Please take good care of yourself.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you again, Joe.
Thank you.
I want to do a deep dive into The Reckoning, Mary Trump's new book, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. Mary, of course, has a PhD from the Dirner Institute of Advanced Psychological Studies at Adelphi University, has taught graduate courses in trauma, psychotherapy, developmental psychology, recently launched a Substack newsletter, The Good in Us, to which I subscribe. So I know that she just came back from Amsterdam and had some great pizza there. I don't know. Hopefully it's not all that jet-lagged. And, of course, the author of her previous book, Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, and her current book, The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. Her website, marytrump.substack.com, and her Twitter handle, Mary L. Trump, at Mary L. Trump. Mary, welcome to the program, or welcome back to the program. It's nice to have you back with us.
Tom, it's great to be here. And I actually do have jet lag, but I'm so excited to be on with you that I feel great.
Oh, bless you.
Good.
Thank you. Your book provokes so many questions. and there's so many things I wanted to talk to you about. I'm really glad that you're able to make the hour with us and we can do this Conversations with Great Minds deep dive here that we rarely do with people and authors, but certainly you're one of the people that I really wanted to do this with. Let me just start with the question, your thoughts on the possibility that your Uncle Donald will run for president in 2024. It looks to me, you know, we know in the first 3 months of this year, I guess it was, that he raised $100 million. I'm on his list. I sent $15 to him, you know, along with about a dozen other candidates back in 2015 during the Republican primary. And so I'm getting 7 or 8 emails a day from him, from his sons, from his friends, from Rudy, you know, begging for money. And I'm guessing that they are dinging the accounts, particularly of elderly people on the edge of dementia who don't remember that yesterday they also gave to Trump. I think, you know, it looks to me like he's just wiping out old people across the country, but maybe I'm completely wrong. But, you know, it seems to me like this is just another big scam to raise money. He's probably raised $200-300 million so far, rather than an actual attempt to run for president. What say you?
Well, first of all, I think you're very brave to be on those lists. I couldn't get all those emails. It would make me insane.
Well, this is what I do for a living.
I know. And that's why I'm glad we have you.
Thank you.
So I don't have to. But, I think part of it is the fact that anybody's allowed to do this without having it be regulated or without having to make an account is a huge problem with our system. But getting back to the broader question, is he going to run? First of all, I kind of resent that people like you and I have to take that question seriously, because I believe we do. I just wish that, the mainstream media would ask a more important question, is why would he be allowed to run? But here we are. I have to say that my thinking on this issue has evolved since the 2020 election. Immediately after that, when he lost so badly to Joe Biden, and was completely humiliated, because in my family, losing is pretty much the worst thing you can do, and being a loser is the worst thing you can be. I said he would never put himself in that position again to suffer such an egregious narcissistic injury. However, what we saw over time was the Republican Party starting to either to back his big lie or remain silent in the face of it and allow him to perpetuate it. That, of course, being that the 2020 election was illegitimate and it was stolen from him because he, of course, won. None of that is true. And then January 6th happened. And as we've seen over time, the Republican Party has also backed him and not put up a fight, and not, they're not supporting the January 6th committee, et cetera. So I think that eliminates one obstacle to his running. The other issue is that the Republican Party is also making it easier for him to run and not lose. In other words, as you know, in every single state, Republican legislatures are trying to push through voter suppression bills. Mm-hmm. So if they can manage to rig the system even more in their favor, and obviously the system is very rigged towards Republicans, and Donald gets that message that if he runs, he can't lose, he might, simply because, although yes, scamming money off of old people is something that he really likes to do, he also probably wants to avoid a lot of the legal jeopardy he's currently facing, both criminally and civilly. So he may come to the conclusion that the best place for him to be is the Oval Office, which would afford him the powers and protections that he probably is really missing right about now. I hope that doesn't happen. His health is also a big concern. And if the wheels of justice could start revolving a little faster, that would be very helpful. But I don't think it's a settled issue one way or the other at the moment.
Yeah, I understand and agree. How, the Republican Party has changed so consequentially in the last 6 months, or last 6 years. Just remember the people that Trump was running against in the primary, there were a few crackpots, but the people like Jeb Bush were just old line mainstream Republicans who just basically wanted to help out rich people with tax cuts and have a decent life. And mm-hmm. now you've got a Republican Party whose heroes are people like Madison Cawthorn and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who respectively said, Cawthorn, after the Rittenhouse verdict, said, Republicans need to be armed and dangerous. And Marjorie Taylor Greene was talking about, blood is the way that you overcome tyranny, and this kind of civil war rhetoric. And it almost always in the context of race. I mean, it has gone from being the party that the dog whistles about race, from Nixon's Southern strategy to Reagan's first public speech as a candidate for president, and down in Mississippi, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney were murdered, and and you know, the Willie Horton ads of George W. Bush. I mean, we know that there's been this racial component, but your uncle just turned it into a front and center thing that people are just essentially proud of. They're no longer even embarrassed by. How right. deep do you think that goes in the GOP? I mean, are most of these people just opportunists who are saying, okay, this is a white supremacist, white nationhood moment in America, so I'm going to ride that wave? Or are these people who have always really believed that white people are the pinnacle of evolution, are destined to rule, that people of color should be in an inferior status, and women, by the way, as well, although we hear less about that, but that seems to be a subset of their agenda. You know, mm-hmm. what's going on in the Republican Party here?
I think it's a combination of both, plus the fact that they see an opportunity that I don't believe would have necessarily presented itself before Donald. Although, let's be clear, I think Mitch McConnell has been doing his part to make sure that the Republican Party maintains power at no matter what cost, even before Donald came on the scene. But what he did do was show them that you can basically get away with anything as long as you keep pushing the envelope and refuse to take responsibility. So the demographic changes in this country have kind of created a sense of urgency that, combined with the fact that they are opportunists who are either comfortable making use of racist tropes or who are themselves white supremacists. And I guess if you're comfortable being with racism, then you probably are white supremacist, has pushed them to this point where they are absolutely willing to do anything to hold on to power, no matter how illegitimately they acquire it. And that's why this moment we face is so dangerous, because they are running out of time. They know that if there were a level playing field, if everybody who is entitled to vote in this country was allowed to vote in this country, Republicans, I don't believe, could ever win a national election again. They're trying to fix it so that Democrats can never win an election again, national election again, through this insane gerrymandering they're doing and the voter suppression bills that they're ramming through, because they only need three states to flip.
Yeah, it is truly breathtaking. We're talking with Mary Trump about her new book, Mary L. Trump, PhD, her new book, The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. And we will get to that as well. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So, Mary, the first part of that question was how has your uncle changed the Republican Party? And my understanding of your answer was basically he showed them how far you can push the envelope, and now they're jumping into that. So the second part of the question is, how long will that last? I mean, what's it going to take for the Republican Party to pull back from that, or to, is it going to take a moral moment, or is it going to take electoral defeat, or are we destined to see a political party that, you know, sort of like the National Socialists did in 1933 or in 1924 in Italy, the Mussolini's party, they're now on a path that they can't turn away from until they flip the country essentially fascist.
Yeah, I don't think that they have any incentive to either abandon Donald or to abandon the path they're currently on. I think we saw in the gubernatorial election in Virginia that Youngkin was trying to find a way to thread the needle of maintaining Donald's support without embracing it necessarily. So I think the Republicans are discovering that they can continue to embrace Trumpism, so-called, without Donald.
But there appears to be quite a backlash in Virginia right now, where Youngkin is being trashed on right-wing message boards left and right. He hired a guy who was gay on his staff, and that's just like produced this total freakout among the mm-hmm. Trump folks.
Yeah, and that's definitely a lesson, sure. But he did win with this strategy of kind of keeping Donald at arm's length. And it obviously, doing something as egregious as hiring a gay person in today's Republican Party will get you backlash. But I think they're all going to learn what line they have to toe. And, if you see the cravenness of people like Ted Cruz, who, by the way, if we had been unfortunate enough to have Ted Cruz as president in 2016, would have dealt with COVID like a sane person.
Mm-hmm.
They are all willing to go down this very dark road. So I think they will come to the point where they realize they don't need him anymore and that it's just going to take off without him. Because, unless I'm wrong, he's not immortal. He won't be around forever. And at that point, all of the things that they helped him, that he helped them reveal about who they are, will have taken even stronger root. And let's be clear, Donald hasn't done anything new. He hasn't changed the Republican Party. He's just revealed who they've always been, I think, at least in my lifetime.
Yeah, and much like the Republicans bound themselves to St. Ronnie after he vanished from the public scene, when he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, he had shown them that you can destroy the unions and Democrats can't stop you and America will not condemn you. And they were like, whoa, really? So it seems like they will continue down this road. If the past is prologue to the future. We're talking with Dr. Mary L. Trump, whose new book is The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. Her newsletter's over at marytrump.substack.com. Talking with Mary L. Trump. Her new book is The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. And you can find her newsletter over at marytrump.substack.com. You can tweet her at Mary L. Trump. Mary, we've been talking about the Republican Party and how it is changing. And I want to, in a small way, come back to that in a little bit. But I'm wondering what, as a psychologist and a keen political observer, and that's one of the things that has always most impressed me about you, is your ability to understand the psychological impact of politics and the political impact of changes, psychological changes in our society and the psychology of the individual politicians, in part from your own experience and in part, I'm guessing, from watching your uncle go through this stuff. But The question is, what does your Uncle Donald Trump have in common psychologically with autocrats that we've seen in the past? I know Hitler comparisons are considered kind of over the top, but you know, there's Mussolini, there's Franco, there's Pinochet, or in the modern era, I mean, you know, people like Modi in India or Duterte in the Philippines or Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, all people who aspire to be, you know, Mussolini level autocrats. What do they have in common psychologically?
Well, I mean, very deep narcissism, which covers over an even deeper insecurity. You know, these are men who were referred to strong men, but the fact that they need the attention, that they crave that level of power, to me suggests that they're incredibly weak. However, they're incredibly good, and I think Donald might be better at this than anybody, certainly better at this than anybody I've ever met. They're incredibly good at finding people who are weaker than they are, which is a trick and a half, because Donald's the weakest person I've ever met in my life. And they're very, very good at instilling fear in people and transforming that fear into anger, because fear is a terribly uncomfortable emotion. It doesn't feel good, but you need it in order to turn it into an anger and sometimes even a rage that can be used for your own purposes if you aspire to be an autocrat. So I think Donald definitely shares all of those traits with the men you mentioned. With this difference, I have never seen anybody who aspires to be an autocrat and be a peer with other autocrats who acts so insecure and inferior around other strongmen. You know, the way he is around Putin is almost inexplicable to me.
Oh, he's like lapdog 101.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And you don't see Putin, Bolsonaro, Duterte, et cetera, acting like that around anybody. So it's that part is kind of stunning. But unfortunately, he has a lot more in common with them than not.
Why don't Republicans recognize that, you know, Trump is behaving like a sniveling underling to people like Putin?
You know, it's very interesting to think about that. And I tried, especially when I was writing my first book, I tried very, very hard to be objective. I took a step back. I tried to figure out what I was missing. There are tens of millions of people who support Donald. There are tens of millions of people who admire him. What are they admiring that I'm not seeing? And then I realized something crucially important. The things they admire, it's not that they found something that I missed. The things they admire in him are the things I revile. And that's the trick.
Yeah, amazing. I want to get into authoritarianism and the slide toward fascism and what do we do about racism in this country with Mary Trump. Her new book, The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. Absolutely brilliant book, by the way. And check out her newsletter at marytrump.substack.com. It's really worth subscribing to. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Conversations with Great Minds with Dr. Mary L. Trump, who has recently launched a new newsletter at marytrump.substack.com. You can tweet her at Mary L. Trump, and is the author, most specifically relevant to this conversation today, with a new book, The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. Mary, by coincidence, during the break, for the maybe third to a half of our audience that are listening on nonprofit radio stations, during the break, the book report that we ran while our commercial stations were doing news was from John Dean and Robert Altmaier, their book, The Authoritarians, and John Dean's book, Conservatives Without Conscience, is based on that as well. I'm sure as a psychologist, you're familiar with this whole idea of authoritarian personalities, and that arguably, according to Altmaier anyway, 20% roughly of any population, any national population, have authoritarian tendencies. Most are authoritarian followers. Occasionally you get authoritarian leaders. I'm curious your thoughts on that. And B, how does that inform our politics and the role in our politics that your uncle has played and that the Republican Party has been playing over the last, arguably the last 40 years, as you know, starting with Nixon's law and order thing, as they've been taking more and more and more, progressively more authoritarian positions, particularly with regard to, people of color?
It's entirely correct that approximately 20% of any population has authoritarian personality or authoritarian leanings. And as you said, that does not mean that you want to become an authoritarian leader. It means that you're more comfortable being a follower, you prefer the status quo, change scares you, you like homogeneity, but it's not a political. It doesn't mean you're more reactionary than anything else. So what I think has happened, though, is that the Republicans have gotten quite good at co-opting such people, and the Democrats haven't figured out how to. Now, for example, one of the most diabolical things Donald did was divide us during COVID at a time we most needed to be united. Now, authoritarian personalities like to be the us in an us versus them scenario. A kind, empathetic, smart leader would have been able to bring those people into the camp, so to speak, by saying it's us, America, against this deadly virus. Donald, on the other hand, because he needs division, he thrives on division, made it us, MAGA, Donald supporters, the Make America Great Again crowd, against people of color, people in blue states, Democrats. It's not at all just because 20% of the population is authoritarian. They're not hopelessly entrenched in right wing politics. We just need to figure out how to talk to them more effectively.
What would be your suggestion to Democrats about how to talk to those Americans, that 20% of Americans who really just want, strong daddy or mommy in charge?
Yeah, that's a lot harder to do now. Because one, the Donald made it so clear that the only way for them to be considered viable was to support him wholeheartedly. We have Fox News spreading his propaganda, spreading their own propaganda. we have this situation in which they're responding more to conspiracy theories, no matter how insane, other than a rational thought. So it's not a quick fix. I think the first most obvious thing Democrats need to do is make American people's lives better, and they need to act like they're in charge because they are. But the clock is ticking. Time is running out. You know, you were talking earlier about the incredible statistics the data regarding what a small minority has veto power over the rest of us. America is not a democracy. That's one of the reasons why. The Electoral College is another. And the filibuster is the one that you were referring to. I mean, the Democrats, if they want to make sure, one, that the American people's lives are better, and two, that America remains or at least continues to have the potential to become a democracy, they need to do the most basic thing and get rid of the filibuster. And then we'll see what happens. But, you know, until such time as they do that, I'm deeply afraid that we will never get to the point where we can start to educate people in a way that is helpful to them.
And I think it would be important for Democrats to realize that the authoritarians loved Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, you know, he came out here. This is on the 360, Sean, if you can fire it up. This is FDR, I mean, responding to attacks from Republicans, right?
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
And that speaks to those authoritarians, you know, followers who are not fascists. They just want some strong character in Washington, D.C. to make the country better. And why can't Democrats learn that lesson now?
I don't know. And it is so effective. And honestly, I think a lot of people would find it a refreshing alternative to the politics of white grievance and whining that goes on, that certainly Donald perfected. So I do not know, but they need to figure it out really quickly, because what we need now is strength, unity, and effective messaging.
Yeah. Let's talk about race for a moment. You talk about this a lot in your book. The issue of race is threaded throughout your new book, The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. Because, of course, that's one of the largest and deepest scars in our national psyche throughout history. Let me back up a little bit. There was a study that was published a couple of years ago that really got my attention. I'm guessing you probably saw it. Where they had taken white rats and black rats, you know, just lab rats that had been bred to have white fur or black fur. And they created this plastic tube. It was about 8 inches long and about 3 inches in diameter that had a door that could easily be opened from the outside, but not from the inside. And so it was like a trap that could be opened from the outside by a rat. They put a black rat in that and put that clear plastic tube in a cage with a bunch of white rats, and the white rats didn't try to rescue the black rat as much as he tried to get out. They reversed it, you know, with black, you know, reversed the race, as it were, of the rats. Same deal. Then they took, in the next generation of rats, when the next litters of rats were born, they took half the black pups from the black mother and had the white mother nurse them, and took half the white pups from the white mother and had the black mother nurse them. And then, so all these black and white rats grew up together, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And then they repeated the experiment, and this time, regardless of what color the fur of the rat was, the rats tried to help the rat of the same, the rat escape. Whereas before, they had only helped the rats of the same colored fur escape. And they had they'd seen this differentiation. Do you see a parallel between that study and how we're dealing with this in the United States? I mean, is You know, we tried this with busing back in the 70s. You know, let's just push people together. I think it actually did some good, but now our schools are more segregated than they were in 1968. What do we do about this?
Yeah, well, yes, it's a fascinating study. And it you know, the one takeaway is that, wow, race is a construct even for lab rats.
That's right.
Right? So I don't know that we've ever tried hard enough, because yes, busing was a potentially effective way, but remember, it was all a one-way street. Only black children were bused to white schools. White children were not bused to black schools.
Yeah.
Because black schools, because of the system, were inferior because they weren't funded properly. I mean, entirely for reasons having to do at the governmental level.
Well, it's why we pay for schools with property taxes. I mean, that goes back to the 1890s, and the whole point was keep the poor neighborhoods with crappy schools.
That's right, and we will never have equity and adequacy in this country if that continues. It's despicable. I've always found it despicable. Don't understand it at all. But that's the way it is right now, and we also need to understand, as you do, that segregation of neighborhoods and schools isn't de facto, it's de jure. And right
under
now,
law.
That's the case, right. It's at the government, local, state, and federal level, neighborhoods and schools are segregated intentionally. And now the reason they're more segregated than ever is largely because of Chief Justice John Roberts.
Right.
So it's, I personally think that one of the best ways to start to deal with this, and this is a decades, generations long project, is for us to start recognizing, at the very least, how we got here and how white supremacy and white privilege continue to be, I think, are this country's biggest problems.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we're seeing more and more minorities in the media, and I think that that's a good step. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, bringing us together and waking people up to the essential humanity of people who don't look like them.
Right.
But, boy, we've got a long way to go. We're talking with Dr. Mary L. Trump. Her new book is The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. So, Mary, I'm looking at, there's this newsletter called The Righting, R-I-G-H-T-I-N-G, and their subtitle is Alerting Liberal Audiences to Today's Headlines from the Right. You know, like, we read the right-wing stuff so you don't have to. Here are some of the headlines from the last 24 hours from major right-wing sites like WorldNet Daily and the Washington Free Beacon and Big League Politics and The Federalist and The Daily Caller and The National Review. Five dead in Waukesha, thanks to the left. The Waukesha, now it turns out the Waukesha driver was a black guy. So number two, the Waukesha slaughter and the plague of black racism. Meet the progressive DA behind the Waukesha bail catastrophe. The persecution of Kyle Rittenhouse. Tucker Carlson's fascinating interview with Rittenhouse. Censoring the pilgrims. The nation's top scientists lied about COVID and got away with it. I mean, it's this continual drumbeat of either racism or embracing Trumpism that seems to me to be disconnected from reality, but they're living in a bubble that is whole to them. How do you penetrate that?
I just want to add that it doesn't help that papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times continue to pile on to Democrats. And the fact that there's no corollary on the left to counter this kind of insanity. I kind of feel about that the way I feel about, people who voted for Donald the second time around. I don't want to waste my time on them. I know that's not a great answer, but there's nothing, I don't think there's anything we can do right now to change the minds of people who are susceptible to that. They've been so convinced over time that being white is not only the most important thing about them, but it's kind of the only thing they have, because they keep voting for people who, you know, won't give them childcare or health care or job security or unions, as you mentioned earlier. And, you know, the best way to think about it is I think about the Pizzagate scandal. People were more willing to believe that Hillary Clinton was running a child pedophilia ring in a basement in a pizza place that didn't have a basement than they were to believe that that was nonsense. So, again, I think at this point it's simply policy. We have to make people's lives better and convince them, or remind them, I should say, that not only is government a force for good, or can be in the right hands for good, but that the government is us. It's not some alien entity that's out to get us. It's us. And they've been convinced that that's not the case. You know, keep your government's hands off of my Social Security.
Right.
Think about the ignorance that's necessary. You know, the longer term solution is, of course, education. We need to teach civics in a way that's meaningful from the time kids are in elementary school. We need to teach critical thinking, and as is becoming more and more important, we need to teach media literacy too.
Yeah, and they're doing that in Finland. Did you catch that story a couple months ago?
Oh, I didn't. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's just remarkable. We're talking with Mary Trump. Her new book is The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back. We're talking with Mary L. Trump, author of The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. You can find her newsletter at marytrump.substack.com, and you can tweet her at Mary L. Trump. Mary, your book is titled The Reckoning, and the subtitle, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. Let me, in the last, you know, 5 minutes or so that we have here, let me just toss this to you. What is our nation's trauma, and how do we find ways to heal? What is The Reckoning?
Our nation's trauma, the original traumas, were the genocide committed against the native population by white people, and the enslavement and genocide of the African population we kidnapped from their homelands. And the reason the impact of those things continue to be operative in American society is because not only have we never atoned for them, we barely acknowledge them. So white supremacy has continued to be an enormously influential belief system in American society, white society in particular. And it's also now a major platform in one of our two major political parties. As you said, there aren't dog whistles anymore. It's just blatant. You need to prove your racist bona fides in order to be a Republican. And the other reason I think that the traumas have been perpetuated over time and that people have become more and more susceptible to accepting criminality and anti-constitutional behavior in their leaders is because America has never held powerful white men accountable for anything, starting with Robert E. Lee, who, by the way, not only was a general for the Confederacy and a traitor to his country, but he owned and tortured human beings, was never punished sufficiently. He became president of Washington University after the Civil War, which was renamed in his honor posthumously, and then Gerald Ford pardoned him in 1974. I mean, it's just absolutely insane. If Robert E. Lee can't be held accountable, do we really expect Donald Trump to be? And if he's not, then there is literally no limit to what people like him or in his party will try to get away with. So how do we heal? We heal by just as an individual who's been traumatized heals. You face the truth about your trauma. You recognize it. You have to get to the point where even though, you know, I'm not responsible for slavery, you're not responsible for slavery, but we have to recognize the ways in which we have benefited from a system that continues to preference white privilege. Because if we don't, the problems continue. So we need to look in the face and say, okay, I'm part of the problem. What can I do to change it? We need to do that as individuals. We need to do that as a country. And we need to do it as soon as humanly possible. And we need to stop pretending that it's in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, as Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative said, slavery didn't end in 1865. It just evolved.
Yeah, well, it's actually still legal in the United States, according to the 13th Amendment. You just have to do it under color of law. You know, somebody who's been convicted of a crime can still be held in slavery and frankly, are all across the United States.
Absolutely.
It's an absolutely extraordinary. The book is brilliant. It's called The Reckoning, Our Nation's Trauma and Finding a Way to Heal. The author is Mary Trump and New York Times bestselling author. Check out her newsletter at marytrump.substack.com. Free subscriptions there, too. And also, you can tweet her at Mary L. Trump. Mary, thanks so much for dropping by. It's great talking with you again.
Tom, thank you so much. This was such a pleasure.
My pleasure, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today is America on Fire by Dr. Elizabeth Hinton. The subtitle, The Untold Story of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. I'm reading from the introduction. On a cold Monday at the start of February, Joseph McNeil, Franklin McCain, Ezell Blair Jr., and David Richmond sat down at a whites-only lunch counter at Woolworths in Greensboro, North Carolina. A waiter refused to serve the young men and suggested they order takeout instead. The four North Carolina A&T students remained at the counter. The store manager approached and asked them to leave. Still, they did not move. A police officer arrived, slapping his nightstick in his hand in an attempt to intimidate. Rather than allow the students' offense against Jim Crow to continue, the manager of the store closed the store for the day. 24 black students returned on Tuesday. Over 50 black students and 3 white students participated in the sit-in on the next day, Wednesday, February 3rd, 1960. News of the protests spread, and soon the sit-in movement had expanded to 55 cities and 13 states. By April, over 50,000 students were involved. Conceived and organized entirely by young people, the sit-in movement ultimately led to the founding of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, S-N-C-C, which was run by activists such as John Lewis and Stokely Carmichael. As a Fisk student, Lewis participated in the sit-ins in Nashville, Tennessee, and he would go on to steer the Freedom Riders in the summer of 1961 and speak at the March on Washington in 1963. Carmichael joined the sit-in movement as a high school student and would famously call for black power at the SNCC rally in Greenwood, Mississippi in 1966. Together, Lewis, Carmichael, and tens of thousands of other young black Americans signaled that their generation was prepared to risk their lives for freedom and equality. From Greensboro onward, the sit-ins helped build momentum and support for racial justice. The students in Greenboro engaged in a nonviolent protest to demand full integration, the right to vote, equal educational opportunities, decent jobs, protection against white supremacist terrorism, and an end to police violence. These were the central aims of the civil rights movement more broadly. By the end of the decade, black students at North Carolina A&T State University were still protesting. But now they were destroying property, assaulting police officers, and shooting in the direction of law enforcement, if not coming close to killing cops in self-defense. In May 1969, after black students at Greensboro's James B. Dudley High School were arrested, brutalized, and tear gassed by police during a series of protests against arbitrary disciplinary measures, A&T students came to the teenagers' defense. The confrontations between local police and black high school and college students led authorities to call the National Guard to A&T's campus, unleashing violence and repression that ended in the killing of sophomore Willie Grimes. A pivotal stop on the road to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 By the end of the decade, Greensboro was a site of sustained violence. It was far from unique in this regard. Between 1964 and 1972, but especially between 68 and 72, the United States endured internal violence on a scale not seen since the Civil War. Every major urban center in the country burned during those 8 years. Violence flared up not only in archetypal ghettos, including Harlem and Watts, and in majority black cities such as Detroit and Washington, D.C. It appeared in Greensboro, North Carolina, in Gary, Indiana, in Seattle, Washington, and countless places in between. Every city, small or large, where black residents lived in segregated, unequal conditions. In the North and the South, the East and the West, the Rust Belt and the Sun Belt, black people threw rocks and bottles at police, shot at them with rifles, smashed the windows of businesses and institutions, hurled firebombs, and plundered local stores. These events, what we commonly call riots, or what people who are to the left of center sometimes refer to as civil disturbances, caused hundreds of millions of dollars of property damage. Most immediately, they shaped the lives of the store owners whose businesses were destroyed, of the parents who lost their teenage sons to the police, and of the firefighters and cops who were harmed or killed. But ever since, Americans have been living in a nation and a national culture created in part by the extreme violence of the 1960s and the early 1970s. The aftershocks of that era have at times taken the form of mass violence to which all Americans have been witness. In Miami in 1980, in Los Angeles in 1992, in Cincinnati in 2001, and in more recent years, in Ferguson, Missouri, Baltimore, Maryland, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. The enduring impact of the violence of the 60s and 70s has been felt more regularly and more acutely by black people in American cities who faced new policing practices that emerged under the banner of the war on crime. The routine stop and frisks that attacked people's dignity, the breaking up of community gatherings, the presence of armed, uniformed officers in the hallways of under-resourced public schools, and more. Such strategies help repress mass violence as a regular phenomenon, but they ironically made further riots inevitable. Those strategies remain in place today. The book, America on Fire. Tom in Champaign, Illinois. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Do you remember discussing a thing called InfraGuard? It's like you apply to it. It's do with the FBI and Homeland Security.
And oh, I was yeah. This many, was like where basically you can become a junior GI man.
Yeah. Well, how many of the people on January 6th were part of that organization?
You think so, or you're suggesting it, or you know it?
I don't know. I'm
you're
just
speculating.
Wondering.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that, Tom. But it is an interesting thing to, it would be an interesting thing to kind of poke around with. Hey, thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Democracy requires all of us, and that includes you. So please, get out there, get active. There's great groups that you can join to get a lot done, not to mention the Democratic Party. Tag, you're it. Have a great afternoon and be good to yourself and the people around you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.